Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Congressional Budget Office's House and Senate Committee health care proposals would drive the nation further into debt. Some members of Congress balk at Defense Secretary Gates's plans to cut back on costly weapons systems. And after 3 days of grilling by the Senate Judiciary Committee, Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor appears headed for confirmation by August. Joining me in the studio for our Friday News Roundup, John Dickerson of Slate.com and CBS, Gene Cummings of Politico, and Michael Crowley of The New Republic. Welcome to you, Michael Crowley.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to see you all. Happy Friday.
Good morning.
Thank you, Diane. Good morning.
Let's talk about the CBO report, John Dickerson, that health care bills will raise the deficit.
That's right. Yesterday, there was this sort of shocking only in that it moved all the players around and upset the current pace of healthcare negotiations, particularly in the Senate, where there's been this debate in the Finance Committee about how to put together a bill. And there's been delay and delay in the Finance Committee. And one of the things they've been debating is how to pay for this expansion of healthcare, one of the key elements. One of the best ways to raise money is to change the tax treatment of employer-provided health care. That is something the president does not want to do, and it's something that Max Baucus, the chairman of that committee, has wanted to do and was pushed away from in recent days. This piece of evidence coming from the Congressional Budget Office is that basically in terms of the long-term health care inflation, current proposals that they measured, and they only measured two, and there are several others out there, healthcare inflation will not go down. In fact, it will increase. One of the things he said would bring healthcare inflation down is this changing the tax treatment of employer-provided healthcare. And those on the committee who would like to follow that route see this as a big piece of evidence in their argument with the president about whether to include this or not. There's a second element, quickly, which is that if you change the tax treatment of employer-provided healthcare, they also argue that it changes the way people use healthcare, which is that they won't waste it and that they will use it more efficiently, and that will change the actual, not just, we're not talking about dollars in this case, we're talking about changing behavior, which is another reason they like it.
Gene Cummings.
Well, it's a nice piece of evidence for proponents of that particular tax, but I don't think it's going to make a difference. The president has been careful not to draw many lines in the sand, and if there's any indentation in the sand, it's right around that tax. And the president isn't alone. It's very unpopular with the public. So all of those nervous Democrats up on Capitol Hill, many of them stand with the president. This is not something they want to do. And one of the big reasons is that not only perceptually is it a problem that they're taxing people's benefits, but it could really affect firefighters and police officers, union members who have negotiated pretty good benefits packages, and as a consequence, dive down into that $250,000 range that Obama doesn't want to cross. And so it's not a solution the White House is interested in. The big winner, I think, might be Baucus, because the head of the Senate Finance Committee is trying to negotiate with Republicans for a different kind of bill. And one of the things they're talking about is moving away from a government plan and initially to start with private-run co-ops. And that seems to be an alternative that could draw bipartisan support, and it's cheaper.
And all this time, Michael Crowley, the public has been calling for a government-run plan. What is going to happen then to a public option?
Well, again, Obama has not drawn red lines. There's a kind of strategic ambiguity to the negotiation going on right now, and it's an open question. I talked to someone yesterday who is completely immersed in this stuff, who thinks that the public plan really could be on the table, that Obama is holding on to it as a strong option, if not a red line, but maybe willing to give it away in the end, that it's not absolutely essential. Rahm Emanuel very much upset some of the president's liberal supporters by suggestion along these lines recently. But I think that what happened yesterday, the debate that's begun about long-term costs, is so interesting and so important, because this is really the heart of Obama's justification for healthcare reform. There is a kind of moral imperative in his argument to covering people without insurance whose individual stories are tragedies. But the issue that you hear coming from people like Orszag in the White House is that long-term cost inflation will literally bankrupt the country. And it seems to me that there is a danger for Democrats right now when you've heard Rahm Emanuel say the only thing not negotiable in this healthcare fight is victory. Well, a victory that doesn't do something about long-term costs really does seem like something you may not want. If you force Democrats to take hard votes to raise taxes and you have not gotten to the heart of things, that seems to me like a victory you may not want, and it will be fascinating to watch.
And the cost issue is, Michael's absolutely right, it is the critical question. And the public plan, while very popular with the public, could rise or fall on that issue alone. If we can't create a government program that is not terribly expensive or can't figure out a way to pay for it, then that is probably going to be the weak spot.
But are we still talking about covering 97% of the American public, John?
Well, that's the second question. The reason this cost issue is such a big deal is that the president has said, this is my standard. It must be scored by the Congressional Budget Office in a way that's deficit neutral and that starts to use their jargon, bend the curve of long-term health care costs, which takes us back to this question of taxing employer health care. Yes, it's quite unpopular, but it goes to the heart of the objectives the president has set for the bill. So it creates this tension here. In terms of insuring the number of Americans, that's also something CBO makes estimates on, and that will depend on what they sort of judge in the final plan. Some of the individual plans that have been put out so far do, over time, get towards insuring 97% or some in the high 90s percentage of Americans.
And what about the president's timeline, Michael?
Well, he's in a big hurry. I think he sees time as his enemy and is pushing Congress to act as quickly as possible. Last night in the House, there was just a wire story that we were given. House members were up until 6 in the morning debating health care minutia, and we're back at it at 9:15 a.m. And I think it's clear that time, particularly in the August lull when Congress has scattered, allows opponents of the bill, industry opponents, for instance, to start honing in their attacks, picking the bill apart in the media. Obama very much does not want that, and I think feels like this is something that has to be done quickly, that you have to get Congress to act at least the first round before the August recess.
And it will be done?
I would say the odds are that it will be done. There is a chance it'll slip, but the president has done this before, setting deadlines for Congress, and it has amazed me, but they've met them. But it's not just because the president is insisting upon it. The arguments that Michael outlined, the members know that too. And so I think, you know, Chris Dodd, they go to the White House, the president says, urgent, get at it, and boom, the next day we have a House bill, and the Senate Health Committee just goes ahead and shoots its bill out. Everything's waiting for Baucus. That's the last big piece.
And this morning's New York Times talks about the absence of Senator Ted Kennedy and what he might have been able to do to bring consensus here.
Absolutely. I mean, he's a lion in the Senate for so many reasons, but chief and foremost is the issue of health care. It's been a lifelong cause for him. He has great bipartisan relationships. He might have been able to really have an impact. He would have had an impact on these negotiations.
Michael.
And I had a fun counterfactual conversation with a friend recently. What if Obama had not made Hillary Clinton Secretary of State? She might be leading the health care charge in the Senate right now as the senator from New York. Now, that could cut both ways. I think you can argue it out, but it is sort of an interesting question to kick around in your mind.
I would just say the reason Baucus is so important is in the Senate there are two bills. One has made it through the so-called HELP Committee. The other one is in the Finance Committee. They have to even begin their public process, which they have not begun. That will take a week or so. Then these two bills will have to be melded together in a process that's kind of nobody's quite sure how that's going to work, even the people in Majority Leader Reid's office. And then they'll begin the public debate. And the number of days is just dwindling to have a robust public debate.
If Baucus manages to get a bipartisan agreement and he's got Grassley on board, I think we will see the Senate move at record speed.
Jean Cumming, she's Politico's assistant Managing editor Michael Crowley is senior editor for The New Republic, John Dickerson, chief political correspondent for Slate.com, CBS political analyst and contributor. And we will take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Well, Gene Cummings, after a week of hearings on the Hill for Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor, the only question that it seems is left is how many Republicans will ultimately vote for.
Yes, I think she's in great shape. She went through the hearings without making any kind of major gaffe at all. She was incredibly boring, which is exactly where she wants to be. There was some levity, but there was very little extreme tension. So it was a very good round of hearings for her. It looks like there may be as many as four Republicans on the Judiciary Committee who will vote for her. There's speculation there might be a fifth. I'm suspicious of that. But I think that we will. Senator Graham has talked about voting for her, Grassley, Senator Hatch, and Senator Cochran. There are some that say Senator Cornyn might consider it, the Texas senator, but being as though he's in the leadership, it might be a tougher vote for him. Although, being from Texas with a great Hispanic constituency, it might be an easier vote for
John.
Him.
And also, Cornyn's in charge of trying to get senators elected, mm-hmm. and being, you know, the Hispanic vote is not unimportant in that cause. Two good things happened for her in addition to her performance. One was Jeff Sessions said he would not, the ranking Republican said he wouldn't filibuster on this bill. And you had two of those Republicans we've been talking about say that her jurisprudence was in the mainstream. That's code usually used for getting rid of judges, and that's a good news for her.
John Dickerson of Slate.com. We'll take a short break. Right back. And we're back with our Friday News Roundup this week with Gene Cummings of Politico, Michael Crowley of The New Republic, and John Dickerson of Slate.com. Do join us. The phones are open, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter, and here's a tweet. Congressional health care proposes to cover 97% of the population. Who are the remaining 3%? Gene Cummings.
Well, that 3% will include, in large measure, probably illegal aliens who will not be able to get coverage because they can't come out of the shadows. And there will be some people who are willing to take the fines rather than pay for insurance. And then there just generally will be people who scoot the system.
Well, yeah, it's very hard to get everyone completely covered. And as you recall, in the campaign, Barack Obama made this clear. He was he's always been willing to say you don't have to have everything. You want to do it as much as you can. Whereas Hillary Clinton was much more emphatic about full universality.
All right, let's talk about what's happening with the bank: J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup. They're all reporting earnings of $3 billion, $4 billion, billions of dollars. What do we make of this, Michael?
It's completely strange, isn't it? I mean, it really seems like the economy is still continuing to slide off a cliff, and yet the glory days on Wall Street seem to come roaring back, but I think it's something of a mirage. It does not indicate better health throughout the economy. To some extent, a couple of these banks like Goldman and J.P. Morgan appear as though they're sort of rising above the rubble and capitalizing from a climate where they have less competition. In some cases, the profits seem like they could be short-term results of short-term asset sales. But look, these banks still have a lot to worry about. There are still toxic assets out there. They still have a lot of trouble on their books. And as long as unemployment is high and consumers are having trouble with credit, making payments, their credit cards, that is not good news for banks in the long term. The interesting last point I would make, the interesting question is politically, how does it look for the Obama administration, which gave these banks so much money to get them through the crisis moment? Now the profits come roaring back, and you know the bonuses are going to start coming back. And as a political proposition, that reignites that very difficult debate that Obama was trying to finesse a few months ago about Wall Street bankers getting big money at a time when Washington is giving them handouts. And that is a dangerous issue. That goes to a kind of populism that Republicans, I think, are trying to stoke, where they see a vulnerability in the Obama administration.
Goldman Sachs already is planning to spend these profits in bonuses. You also had another report by the Treasury Department this week that looked at the banks, some of the banks getting bailout money, and basically found that lending was flat. So the theory was that we've got to bail them out because they are the engine of the economy to get credit into the market and get businesses going again.
But there's no credit going into the economy.
Right. So, and then I guess the final third point I would make is Republicans are seizing on the success, both of the success or failure of the stimulus package and these bailout packages, as a way of saying, look, we were rushed into all of this because the president said there was an emergency, much the same way he says there's an emergency in healthcare now. Things didn't turn out to be the way they were as promised on these two fronts, with the stimulus bill, with the judgments about where the economy would be. So if they were wrong about that, they're also wrong about healthcare.
Well, you know that the world has really been turned upside down when Republicans complain about Wall Street making money. I mean, where have we come to? I mean, the bottom line is, this is not bad news. We want to recover. And I agree with Michael. I think we've got a long way to go. I think we're on a roller coaster. I talked to a lot of economists last week and this week to try to take a measurement of where we were. And all of them, Republican and Democrat, told me we are nowhere near out of this. We are not.
Exactly.
And so we'll go up and down. And this, you know, this is a good sign for us.
And it is a very defining moment between Wall Street and Main Street, because you've got unemployment increasing, projected to increase even more. You've got these banks making huge profits, giving out huge bonuses, and there's a disconnect there that doesn't work.
And it's not healthy for American society. I don't want to get too esoteric about it, but there's something unhealthy and even alarming about this sort of thing happening, where people, I think, feel like the system is rigged in favor of a small number of wealthy and powerful people whose companies, whose former chairmen are populating the government and helping to make decisions about who gets bailed out. And I think that can be very toxic for broader public confidence in our political and economic system.
And then there's CIT, John Dickerson.
Well, CIT, which is not getting any more help. It got a little over $2 billion worth of help. And the interesting question to watch with CIT is CIT basically funds, although it's slowed to a trickle, but funds small businesses and particularly retailers, so that if you get orders from a retailer, you go to CIT and say, hey, look, I've got these orders, loan me some money so I can make the goods to fulfill these orders. So, and they CIT does about 60% of that business. CIT may disappear,
may go under,
and the question is then what does that do to retail? The argument the administration makes and others who want to let CIT fall and not rescue it is that basically that business can be picked up by somebody else, kind of bought by a competitor, and it will continue on, and it won't be this huge implosion of the retail sector that
they're testing the system. They're going to test the system. I mean, we have gone through a period where everybody got bailed out. And now they're going to – Lehman was the last one that was allowed – last big one that was allowed to go. And the system could not absorb that. And so now they're testing the system. In addition, what they have concluded, in addition to the fact that the competitors can take up the business, that they looked at CIT and didn't see it at having any kind of real measurable recovery. They think the company is lost. And so in that case, it would make no sense at all to send federal bailout money to a company that the Treasury Department has no confidence can recover.
Yeah, just not salvageable. And I think we're already looking at having lost a couple of billion dollars on it. Look, if there's any note of optimism to inject, if it is a situation where the transaction can be picked up by others, the economy is going through big structural changes.
Sure.
The hope, and I don't want to root for anyone to lose jobs, but the hope is that there are new efficiencies brought in as a result of this, and we're smoking out some of the weaker legs in the economy.
Well, and at the same time, you've got the states undergoing shifts and downsizing, and California on the verge of going broke, Michael.
Yeah, well, California has been, I think, through the night trying to come up with a budget deal that will save them.
What's the problem?
Well, the problem is that they just don't have money. I mean, the revenues, their tax revenues are plunging. I think that they lost another $2.7 billion in expected revenues, which is forcing across-the-board cuts, including...
Because of the referenda that the population itself passed.
Well, that causes problems in a number of ways. It's shrunk the amount of money they got, and it also it sets the targets in some ways, particularly for education funding.
Right.
You've got to have a certain level. The governor tried to repeal Prop 98, which set the education levels, and that didn't work. And so the negotiations are somewhat hampered by these referenda that have passed.
California also has a very unique tax structure, and it's very much a boom-bust tax structure. It's very sensitive to those cycles. So in the booms, when Silicon Valley was on fire, California was flush. And then when a bust hits, this is what happens to their state. But it is true what you're saying. I mean, the states can't print money like the federal budget. The federal government can, and beyond California, there are a host of governors who are swimming in red ink.
Governor Rendell was talking this morning on Morning Edition about the reason he's staying home from the governor's conference is to deal with budget issues.
Yes, and this leads to another interesting question you could devote an entire hour to, which is, does Washington need to do another stimulus bill? Does Washington need to pump a lot more cash into these states? And it's a rock and a hard place, because people say you're going to have to put more cash in the economy, but the Congress is not going to accept it, at least not for several months. But that does seem to be one of the best outlets, because Washington can print those bills that the states cannot.
All right, let's talk about the F-22. Michael, one of the other sort of thumbs in the eye of an awful lot of people, why is Secretary Gates saying, let's pull the funding for the F-22?
Well, the F-22 is this almost science fiction style advanced fighter jet that is supposed to actually leapfrog a generation of fighter jets and guarantee America air superiority in the skies for a generation. I think it's been something like 10 or 20 or more years since a U.S. fighter jet has been shot down in combat, and they want to keep it that way. Gates is trying to restructure the Pentagon budget to steer us away from sort of futuristic giant conflicts, say, with a great power like China, and make us more adaptable to the kinds of conflicts we're engaged in now, in counterinsurgency in places like Iraq and Afghanistan.
How much does the F-22 cost each year?
Well, I don't know the annual budget. I know that the Senate vote to extend production of the F-22, Gates wants to cut it off at 187 fighters. The Senate wants 7 more, and the first installment of that is going to be $1.75 billion. You're talking billions and billions of dollars.
And who's fighting against that?
Saxby Chambliss, in particular, senator from Georgia, Republican. I think these things cost about 150 a clip, and 150
that's
million.
That's
million.
Yeah.
So, and they're already a bunch of them made. And Gates just wants to stop at the current level
and
of 187
well,
or so.
They haven't been used.
Well, because we're not having the kind of conflicts as
exactly.
Michael pointed out. And the I mean, it's not like Gates is cutting them off. They've got 187 in the pipeline.
Right.
And so the additional ones that Congress is adding, he wants to take that money and really adapt our military war machinery to what we face. There are, you know, there were times when Gates got to the Pentagon and his soldiers were getting blown up in these roadside, with these roadside bombs. And he turned to his people and said, get me some kind of equipment that can identify where there is a roadside bomb. And there was talk about, well, we have to, you know, develop all of these guidelines for it, and then we have to put it out for contract and blah, 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 blah. And meanwhile, his soldiers are getting killed yes. on a daily basis. And this was an enormous frustration to him and one of the reasons that he is being so aggressive about trying to turn this corner. And Obama is standing next to him with a veto threat that if they add this kind of F-22 money in, he's threatening to veto the defense authorization.
Well, because several Democrats, including John Kerry and Ted Kennedy, of all people, suddenly have seen the light, big, expensive defense programs. And why is that? Because this is a great story of how Washington works. A former Pentagon official testifying before Congress earlier this year admitted that when the program began, the contracts were consciously distributed around the country to invest as many House members and senators as possible in jobs in their states and districts. Not only that, but this official said, we intentionally lowballed the cost of this program to get it off the ground. We knew it was going to go up. The price tag was going to go up. And now all these members of Congress are invested in sustaining it because there are jobs in their states and districts, even though the price tag has gone through. And that's how Washington works, particularly when it comes to defense contracting.
You know, it really... I know that journalists are supposed to be stand back and simply report the news, but I got to tell you, it makes me angry that that kind of money is going because a congressional mandate is there.
Well, just one little more piece of detail on Saxby Chambliss, which I didn't get to conclude, which is that the F-22s are made in Marietta, Georgia, which is the key and relevant fact
exactly.
to his opposition. He's not the only one,
right.
But he's one of the ones pushing.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about the president's statement to the NAACP last night. Michael, how strong was his statement?
Well, you know, Obama has always had an interesting relationship with the African-American community in the U.S. because he is a figure of great inspiration, needless to say. But he also has this side where it's kind of what I call the Bill Cosby side, where he says, you know, no excuses. Don't wallow in the pity of your circumstances, however hard they might be. Turn off the TV, turn off the Xbox if you're a parent. I thought the best part, the strength of it, was the personal element. Obama apparently worked on the speech through the day just up until he presented it, and he had a line in there about passing young men out on street corners in poor neighborhoods and saying, "There but for the grace of God go I," and then spoke directly and said, "All you potential Barack Obamas out there, no excuses. Don't just succumb to that." And I thought that was really powerful and struck a nice balance between him both being an inspirational figure, but also kind of giving some tough love to a community that maybe can use it.
One of the things that I thought was the most remarkable about that speech is that no other president could deliver it. Only an African-American president could give that speech and give that kind of tough love. It was such a turning point conversation.
And the other element is, what is he saying to the NAACP about its own future?
Well, that's right. Just one quick thing on that. It's not just that he's African-American. He's an African-American whose father abandoned him,
right,
which is the narrative
right.
here. And he told
exactly.
this part of his story was about his mother. And it was about black men behaving, but also mothers getting involved, as his was. And so he could relate to that, to his own personal story in that regard. His message to the NAACP in what's supposed to be this sort of post-racial era that he's in part supposed to have ushered in, it was still, though, nevertheless, he said, you know, we know everybody's hurting, but African-Americans are hurting more. But I think his message to the NAACP was to sort of update a little bit with the times.
And not only that, but a point I thought was very interesting, which is, it's amazing that we're at a point where he has to say this, but he almost kind of said discrimination is not gone in America. There were some people, I think there is a concern among some African Americans, I should say, that Obama's election may have created a perception in the country that we've kind of taken care of racial discrimination, and we are not in a post-racial country yet. Obama may be a post-racial figure, but a lot of those problems still remain, and I think Obama was rooting on the NAACP to carry on that fight and saying that work is not done despite the fact that I am in the Oval Office.
The other thing that I thought was interesting was the way he wove the NAACP and the continuing challenges to the African-American community with his own domestic agenda. And he talked about health care. He talked about jobs. And, you know, that the mission and cause and the issues that face the African-American community are not unique. They are American challenges, and they are the challenges of the nation as well.
Do we know how much of that speech he wrote himself and how much was written for him, Michael?
I couldn't tell you the proportions. I can tell you that they were late in getting advanced texts of the speech out, if at all. I'm not sure exactly when they came out, because he was working on it through the day, and it sounded like it was a very personal involvement for him.
Michael Crowley of The New Republic. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. The cleric behind Iranian opposition leader Mousavi delivers a rebuke to Iran's supreme leader at Friday prayers. And two American-owned hotels in Jakarta are the target of bomb attacks. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup with John Dickerson, Gene Cummings, Michael Crowley. Let's go right to the phones. First to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Bill. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. One of your guests earlier said, in reference to these bonuses for the bankers, that he didn't want to get too esoteric, and the trend between high pay for those people and the rest of us being laid off was dangerous. The American people might conclude that these people had special access. Well, how naive. We know they have special access. Both political parties in this country are owned by special interests. This is a news flash. Secondly, if Obama and the Democrats don't get the economy straightened out by next year at this time, they're going to take a big hit in the midterm elections.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Bill. Gene.
Well, he raises what I think is always a tricky point for these administrations, and that is that Goldman Sachs is always the one that's riding to the rescue, whether it's a Republican or a Democratic administration. And Goldman Sachs now comes out on top. And that certainly will feed criticism that there was some inside dealing going on.
What does that mean, inside dealing?
Well, you know, who gets bailed out and who doesn't? I mean, if you look at who's emerging here, this has created real winners and losers. And Goldman Sachs executives were on the inside making decisions.
And when AIG gets bailed out, AIG gets bailed out so that it can pay back Goldman Sachs.
It may not even be inside dealing necessarily. It could just be the innate sympathies that senior government officials have for their former colleagues, a sense that Goldman's a good place. I've been there. They know what they're doing. They can be trusted with our money. So it's actually subtler than that, which in some ways is harder to prevent.
Well, and if you look at the reality, Goldman Sachs got through this better than most.
One caller asks, if the economy is struggling so much, where are the banks getting their large profits?
It's not entirely clear to me, I have to be honest. I do know that one thing that Goldman did to make so much money is that they were assuming higher levels of risk. That was the analysis that I saw, which gave me real pause. I'm not sure that we want banks to be trying to dig their way out of the hole by taking on greater risk. That actually seems like a real problem and a reminder that we still have not put reforms into the financial system, so we actually don't know necessarily exactly what they're doing, how much risk they're assuming, and if it backfires, then what?
Gene.
Well, they also, some of the reports said that they also had written down the value of some of their assets, assuming that the recession would go deeper, and it did not reach to the level that they had previously thought, and so those assets actually could be valued higher.
Okay. Lockheed Martin and the Air Force say that each of the F-22s cost $143 million, but the real cost approaches $350 million each. And Barbara writes, thanks for talking about the F-22. It seems the Pentagon leadership wants to fight terrorists while the House Armed Services Committee wants to fight aliens. Well, let's go to Margate, Florida. Good morning, Jeremy. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Here. Just a quick, simple talking point on health care that I don't hear in the rhetoric or the debate, and I'd love to hear it discussed. And that is, if we do provide health care for all Americans, 97%, how many of these entrepreneurial-minded Americans who probably could start a business or have a business plan, but currently it's the cost of health care that's preventing that calculation from being feasible? You know, how many of these untapped, unbridled Americans could start a business if health care was provided? Currently, I think a lot of us are in jobs that we may or may not want to be in, but it provides great health care for our families.
John.
This is the so-called job lock, which is one of the things the administration talks about a lot in terms of making health care portable or making at least it accessible to everyone. And that is basically all of the economic activity that is pent up as people stay in jobs because they're getting some kind of health care and they're worried if they leave, they won't. The opposite side of this, of course, are those who say small businesses will be hurt by some of these mandates. But most of the legislation has protections so that if it's a very small business, the mandates don't apply.
Here's an email on health care from Kevin. He says, I'm a bartender and student. I don't have health insurance. Most of the people I know don't. Yet this debate remains mostly between people who do have health insurance. I hear no talk of a single-payer system, yet everyone I know talks about this. We want this. Politicians, media, etc., refuse to talk about it. Kevin, I do want you to know that this show did a full hour on a single-payer plan with advocates here in the studio. However, when it comes to the health care issue, he says, we the people, the poor and uninsured, still do not have a voice. John?
Well, he's right. Now, it's not it doesn't go undiscussed. The president is asked about this multiple times at every of these one of these town halls he goes to, and his argument basically is, if we were starting from scratch, I wouldn't mind such a thing,
right.
But we're not, and therefore. So that's then all of the energy gets into the debate about the public plan or the public option. The president has said that the public option would be available to anybody who doesn't have health insurance. Those who are at the lower end of the income scale would get subsidies of some sort. Now the debate, though, is how does that manifest itself in the various pieces of legislation? Some pieces of legislation have a public plan that's closer to what the advocates of a single payer would like. What's being debated in the Senate Finance Committee is this public plan slash co-op. And at the end here, what will be interesting is how we name these things and what the public what the co-op ends up looking like. Will it be big enough? Who will have control over it? Will it just be the people, the individuals, the patients who form the co-op, or will there be a government entity that will run it and so forth and so on, which will determine whether this actually gets anywhere towards actually being a viable
All right. Here's an email from Caroline in Baltimore. Why can't the Obama administration limit Wall Street bonuses? If not, why weren't there bonus limits when the bailouts were handed out?
Well, Michael. Again, we see how the debate is returning to where we were in, I think, January or February. These questions of what is the proper government role in trying to regulate the private sector, trying to impose limits on bonuses. I think that there's a feeling that there's only so much intervention the Obama administration wants Washington to have in those sorts of private sector decisions. And the banks also make a not crazy argument that the bonus system is what attracts the best talent and makes them good at what they do. It makes people work hard to make profits.
But they were terrible. They were terrible.
Well, some of them were. I mean, yeah. The subprime stuff got out of hand. But
right.
There are like entire other divisions of these companies that had no role in the subprime mess.
But they're saying that they're the only people who can fix the mess, and they were part of the problem.
Well, many, like at AIG, the executives that were responsible for the unit that basically brought the company down, they aren't the ones fixing it.
Right.
They brought in people from other divisions. And I tell you, I can't walk in there and fix this. It does take a highly sophisticated and smart person to
All
do
right.
this stuff.
Here's an email from Donya in Scottsdale, Arizona. She says, as a woman lawyer who's appeared before demanding judges for 25 years, I cannot imagine Senator Graham asking a male Supreme Court nominee if he had a demeanor issue or was a bully simply because he asked tough questions. This is the double standard women in law have been fighting for decades. When a man does it, it's admirably tough. When a woman behaves the same way, she's overly aggressive.
Well, there's no question about it that there are different standards, and words in one context are going to be viewed differently than in another context. And, you know, this is our life, and she got through it just fine. And, I mean, it's, considering that she's now cruising towards her nomination, I'm sure she's not going to worry too much about it.
Can I just make a point
sure.
about the hearings more generally? I agree with you, but I think that there was something disappointing about it as a civic exercise, leaving aside that particular point. It's become such a farcical, I don't even want to call it theater, because there's no theater
sort
to
of
it.
Trying to break down somebody.
But everyone has perfected the art of
yeah.
not being broken.
Right.
The questions, the senators even to some degree know they're not really going to get through. They're just kind of talking to their constituents. There are these very nuanced maybe messages to special interest groups, but it just seems like the whole process is should be rethought, because it's just become something of a farce and frankly a waste of everyone's time and a disappointing civic exercise in which the average American learns virtually nothing about the law and how the court really works.
To Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I find the conversation about the health care getting that through, frankly, infuriating. As a conservative, you know, the reporters need to get out more because out here in the country, to have a bill going through that is going to cost billions of trillions of dollars, and to say we've got to get this done by August, and then you guys just accept it as the way that it should be. It's like you've taken a Rahm Emanuel crash course or something, and we just got to get legislation done. If it's bad legislation, like the cap and tax bill, then it's bad legislation. I mean, that thing got through and nobody read it.
Michael.
Well, it's Obama's position that the bill has to be gotten through by August. I don't think we're here lobbying for health care reform. I want to make that distinction. This is an analytical point and also conveying that this is what the Obama administration feels is essential. And it's also not that health care is going to be completed by August with a bill passed and signed. It's a matter of getting through that first stage of congressional votes, and then they will come back and do something after the August recess. So you're not going to be taking a break in the middle of August, and you're going to have a whole new health care system already. We still have a ways to go.
Right. And also, as we mentioned, we also reported the other side of this, which is that Republicans are saying if you look at the stimulus bill and these bailouts, which were rushed through under cover of emergency, as the health care bill is right now, Republicans are saying that's moving too fast and it's going to make sloppy legislation, which is, I think, the caller's point.
All right. To Barnhart, Missouri. You're on the air, Joe.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was thinking earlier one of your panelists said that, they rushed through the spending bill for the bailout for the banks, and that was proving to be problematic right now because they're paying it back so fast with our profits. And now they're saying they're rushing through the health bill and everything, but that was two different administrations, and that's my point.
All right. Thanks for calling.
One other point to consider is that the health care is not exactly a new issue in this town. This health care debate has been going on for a decade. So there are many areas of agreement and consensus that have already evolved. They're still trying to work out some of the toughest nuts.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Canton, Michigan. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling regarding a white paper that I read about high-frequency trading on Wall Street. And Goldman Sachs recently reported that one of their software programs was stolen that could manipulate the stock market. And this high-frequency trading that's really on the New York Stock Exchange, these banks or investors can scalp a couple of pennies from the stock market within a millisecond of a buy-and-sell trade. And it just seems like additional thievery on Wall Street. And I wondered what the panel thought about that issue.
Interesting. I heard about that on All Things Considered.
Yes.
Gene.
Yes. I don't think I'd call it thievery. That's the race. That is the highly overheated, competitive environment that is Wall Street.
But and if you're he is saying that they have equipment that moves than anything anybody else has.
Well, and that's competition. You know, they beat them, and now somebody's stolen their computer program, and that is truly theft.
Right. Well, and it may also feed the perception, perhaps I was wrong to use the word esoteric, as the caller mentioned before, but that there's an inside game, that people who have the connections and have the best computer software, they're the ones who are always going to be making money in the end at a time when others are striking
out. But they're trading, you know, on behalf of 401ks and pension plans. Mm. I mean, it's not like it's their – I mean, it might be partly their personal trading. But, I mean, it's this buying and selling represents also a great deal of money that belongs to middle-class Americans.
Okay. Here's an email from Andre, and he's looking at CBO's forecast ability. He says, we can read from the AP that CBO Director Douglas Elmendorf said of the legislation so far, we do not see the sort of fundamental changes that would be necessary to reduce the trajectory of federal health spending by a significant amount. So, what is the track record of the CBO when it makes that kind of forecast?
It's very hard to make long-term forecasts. I mean, I think budget estimates are notoriously unreliable. Predictions of economic growth are notoriously unreliable. And there are defenders of the Obama administration who say that when Obama is being attacked, slightly to divert from the specific point of healthcare, but on deficits in general, that
it's so hard to pin down what the numbers are going to be like, that yes, you do want to pay attention to how much is going out the door, but fixating on precise number, there's only so precise you can be after a certain point. But I do think that there is evidence that the tough cost controls in the health plan that's coming together really aren't there yet.
And also, CBO admits that over – there are two things here. One is, how do you pay for this over 10 years? The second is, how you pay for it long term. CBO admits you can't guess about the long term. But what they're talking about here is not specific numbers, but trends. And that's the problem here, because that's what the president has said should be at the core of this. The trend has got to change. And CBO says not only will it not change the trend, it will exacerbate it.
Last word, John Dickerson of Slate.com. He's also a political analyst for CBS. Gene Cummings, Politico's assistant managing editor. Michael Crowley, senior editor for The New Republic. I will be off for the next 2 weeks, taking a little break for vacation. Lots of good colleagues sitting in for me over that period. I'll be back with you on August 3rd. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.